trying to start on time.
Yeah.
Reason one, because I want to fit everything in today and have an ambitious program. And reason two is because Robert's been bothering me for weeks about starting on time.
Reason, because it gets so frantic at the end.
Because we don't have enough time, yes. So his point is well taken. So he says if you start at 5 after, people get here at 5 after. You start at 10. Okay, so we're starting. I'm going to be very time efficient today. Any announcements? Let's do announcements right now, if there are any.
I have one.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm New Year Park here, and I have a credit note for $250 for OfficeMart, and I don't need anything to buy. If anybody buys from OfficeMart, can you help me reduce that credit note? I would be very
grateful. Whoa. Whoa. Right. I think I like that. Okay, other announcements?
I have one.
Julie.
Yep, you can get time with that gift tomorrow.
What?
Julie's our timekeeper.
You can get time with that tomorrow. And then next week's the last week of class.
Okay, so I guess I'll talk about class then. So daylight savings time, believe it or not, starts tomorrow night. Okay. So great. Okay, class next week. Class next term. Yeah, do sign in. Class next term starts at 10:15 and goes to 11:45. It's 15 minutes later. I'm sorry that may inconvenience some folks. Need to sneak out a little early due. The problem was that there's a class in here before, and they started too early, so they wanted to go a little later. And so they asked us for 10:30 to 12, and they said that might kind of inconvenience people with 12 o'clock appointments. So we compromised. So we're going to try it at 10:15 next term.
In here?
In here. Everything is the same except 10:15 to 11:45.
And what's the title of the class?
Consciousness class.
And next week, the end of the class, tell them.
Yes, the last class of this term is next week, and Marty Glenn will come back, and we'll be talking about the consequences of gestation and birth for adult personality, how to change adult personality given how deep the roots go, and somatic psychology. That is how one's history is stored in one's body. That's what we're going to do next week. Any other comments or questions before I give a very brief meditation instruction, and then we meditate. It's Suzanne.
Yes. What's the date of the new term?
Second week in April. Is it April? Did anybody got it? Is it April 11th?
April 11th.
April 11th.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. These guys are getting set. All right. I'm not going to give a lot of instruction about mindfulness today because I want to be time efficient. I don't know if you will or not. That'll be at 11:30. That's many worlds from here. Okay, so just in terms of mindfulness, if you're doing mindfulness during the meditation period, you're balancing two things. You're balancing relaxing and opening on every level that you find contraction or tension. And there are level after level after level of contractions that one discovers, one is fascinated by, and then one opens beyond. So it's as though the borders of your body and mind are dissolving or spreading outward. So ultimately what's left is an infinite field of awareness in all dimensions and a consciousness in the middle of it. So everything else gets surrendered, gets let go, until there's simply open awareness and a noticing. So the first thing you're doing is you're letting go, you're opening up, you're softening, you're surrendering on every level. And the second thing you're doing is you're paying closer and closer attention to what you notice. So your attention gets sharper as your edges get softer, if you will. So you balance those two things. you might want to do some labeling in order to sharpen your focus. A thought. Sensation. Feeling. Thought. So you might call, you might say to yourself for a minute or two what you're noticing to sharpen that perception. Okay? All right, so we're going to sit. If everybody's seated pretty much, we'll sit. What about the doors? Shall we close the doors?
Yes.
For people who came at the usual time, it's a new regime. We're trying to start more promptly. Okay, so here we go.
Boy, I can sit for hours. It's not good.
Okay. 10 minutes. announcement I want to make is you may have seen on the table a place for you to indicate your birthplace. We're going to make a map of where in the world we all came from to come to this place at this time. So that's over. If you didn't do it today, you can do it next week. It's voluntary, of course, but if you put your name and your birthplace, we'll be able to make that map. Michael?
Should we also include the place of conception? Just
talk to Donna.
I don't want to know. Okay.
Here's the life stories book. If anybody wants to put anything in here, make two copies, give them to Donna. You can also, you're also welcome to borrow this, if you like. Okay, I want to do in 15 minutes, I want to finish the chakragram. So if you have your chakragram, take it out. If you don't have it, I have a few extra copies here. We're going to run through this really quickly. So if you need one, the first four of these energy centers. And again, these may or may not correspond exactly to the chakras. They don't correspond exactly, but they may or may not correspond reasonably well to the chakras. I'm going to call them energy centers. So let's look at 5, 6, and 7 now, the top three. The first four are basic needs that we share with pretty much every living thing. The fifth starts to be more uniquely human, and the sixth and the seventh are uniquely. Well, the sixth is uniquely human, the seventh is an open question. The word associated with the fifth energy center, which is mouth, throat, lungs, is self-expression. Self-expression. And the statement, it's not a question for the fifth, the statement is, here I am, exclamation point. Here I am, exclamation point. So, the fifth is like an overtone of the third. The third has to do with identity, becoming a self. The fifth has to do with sharing the self, with interchanging with the world. This is where you bring in food, where your voice comes out, where you breathe in and out the rest of the world. So this is the primary medium of interchange between the individual and the world, in one sense. So how do you open that up if you have some blockage there? And you can frequently hear blockage there when you listen to people talk, because they don't really talk all, you can hear these repressions, or these constrictions. So how do you open that up? One way to open this up is creativity. Creativity is the bringing out of the inner you to the world in terms of a painting, a poem, a dance, a song. Whatever it is that you bring out of yourself, you have to have courage to do that. Because one part of you is going to think, oh, this is bad, or I'm not talented, or they'll laugh at me. But if you If you cultivate creativity as a daily practice, then after a while you don't care about whether they laugh at you or not. It's about being true to who you are and letting the world see who you are. Remember I talked about this being the flower? If you don't show the world your flower, you don't get pollinated. Other things you can do. I'm going to spend 5 minutes in the area, so we got to be very efficient. Other thing you can do, assertion training. Those of you who know what assertion training is, it has to do with saying what's going on with you, with not being inhibited about telling the world how you feel. If you make new statements, people will jump on. Well, that's a bad strategy. People will fight with you if you make new statements. But if you make I statements, the world has a tendency to listen to you and to reconform itself around your needs. So you say, I don't feel good in this situation. That's different than saying you're making me feel bad in this situation. So assertiveness has to do with making, with not being silent, not being aggressive, but making I statements. Telling the truth. You can become a votary of truth. You can say, even though they're going to put me in prison for this or laugh at me for this, it is my vow to tell the truth. I have to have whatever I see as the truth, I have to say, this is what I see as the truth. So you can become a votary of truth, and that can overcome your reticence to share your point of view. You can sing or play an instrument. Singing is good because it works on breathing. And people with fifth chakra difficulties, they have a tendency not to breathe diaphragmatically and fully. So singing is a great thing to do. Also, you have to overcome a lot of fear if you're to sing in front of people.
So does that make a wind instrument good?
It makes any instrument good. The next thing is play an instrument. Wind instrument might be particularly good, but any instrument, you have to have the courage to make mistakes and learn the instrument, and people hear it. It comes out of you. So that's the fifth energy center, ways to open up your self-expressiveness so that you share with the world who you are. Otherwise, the world doesn't get the benefit of who you are. And you don't get the benefit of the world interchanging with you. If you're invisible, the world will not pay attention to you. Sixth area, about at the level of the brain, forehead. The word is understanding, and the statement is, I want to know, exclamation point. I want to know. So how do you open up? It's remarkable how many of us have learned that we're not intelligent. We've been shut down by school. The thing that's supposed to open us up is shut many of us down. And so we think, I can't understand that. That's too complicated for me. That's above my head. I never understand stuff like that. Or you, after a while, you don't even try because you think, I just don't have it to comprehend that. That's really the fruition. If the fifth was a flower, the sixth is a fruit. The fruition of a human being is the ability to live larger than one's individual self, but to bring in other people in the world into one's comprehension. So one's life experience is not just individualized, it becomes more and more generalized and rich. So one thing you can do to open up a closed or a semi-closed, things you won't think about, things that are wrong to think about, things you can't think about, open all that up, is you can try new things. You can take a class in something you've always been interested in, but that you know nothing about. You can go to new places. If you always go to dinner over there on Friday night, you can try going to lunch over there on Saturday afternoon, or even something, you know, some other. How many of you, just on a very prosaic level, how many of you, when you drive around Santa Barbara, know what's up each street? If you don't, why not? That's called curiosity.
It's called riding a bike.
I wonder, or you can walk, or you can ride a bike, but even if, right, but even if you don't, when there's the question, why don't you just turn up that street once to see what's up there? This is Santa Barbara. There is cool stuff up there. You more generally, you can travel. Travel really broadens your life experience. It really opens your mind up. You see how differently different people see the world, and how much of difference there is in the world, and how much sameness there is in the world. You can use the media. That's the really great boon of our age, it seems to me, is the fact that we have infinite life experience in front of our eyes. We can pull in amazing experiences that nobody else could, prior to March, to 50 years ago, nobody could have these experiences. Want to know what it's like to be an astronaut? Go see gravity. You know, I mean, it's amazing. Okay. Media, okay? Other two things. By the way, go see gravity in 3D. And sit close. Then even the astronaut dream will die hard. Mentors. It's really helpful to have people who model intellectual curiosity and courage. And also people who know what you want to know, because then you can follow them around and learn that, and you have help. So mentors are really important here, and hobbies. Hobbies really, they cause you to have to learn, to master new tasks and learn new things. So hobbies are not secondary. Hobbies are a real opening, opportunity, comes to the mind. All right, the last energy center, highest energy center, is, I put it in two places. I put it either crown of the head and above the head, and at the core, because people feel connected to something greater than themselves, either vertically, that's not right, okay. You can feel, I'm mixing two different thoughts, so I'll parse out the thoughts. You can, spirituality can be either vertical or horizontal or both. That is, people that have vertical spirituality feel like there's something above us, transcendent to us, that we're connected to. People who have horizontal spirituality feel like we are connected to life on the earth in a larger way, or to other people, or to the ecosystem. So the connection is to everything on this plane. So you can be either vertically spiritual or horizontally spiritual or both. And you can find that spirituality either as something coming from above or as something coming from within. And different traditions emphasize those two different roots. So I put them both together. The word here is unity. Unity. And the question is, what is the nature of existence? What is the nature of existence? I said this before, if you don't have an open seventh area, then life is a tragedy, because when your individual life goes, there's nothing left. But if you have this increasing sense of how you're interconnected, interbeing is what Thich Nhat Hanh says, how you're interbeing with everything else, then your life opens into a larger sense of life. So here are some ways that you can open, and we have trouble in our culture as for reasons which, because we're science is our predominant myth in our culture, that myth we're going to kind of shake a little bit today, and in the future maybe even deconstruct a little bit. But that myth basically tells us that we're individual ping pong balls in an unfeeling universe, you know, and that we really are isolated. So how do you overcome that brainwashing? One thing you can do is you can do philosophical or spiritual study. That is, you can read the philosophers or read spiritual wisdom and take it seriously. Maybe these people aren't deluded. Maybe there's actually something that they're in touch with that you could become better in touch with. So you can do study. Second thing you can do is you can do direct experience. You can practice some kind of spiritual discipline and on a serious basis, so that the opening that is promised by that discipline becomes something that you can do. or that you is available, might be available to you. You can pray. Even if you don't know what or whom you're praying to, you can do that on a regular basis because it seems to deepen your sense of what life is and connect you in some ineffable way. And the fourth thing you can do is you can contemplate death. You can make that a serious contemplation. Because that's that can be a powerful opening meditation. Okay, so those are a few of the ways that you can work on yourself to open those areas of your life that are somewhat constricted, so that you can live fully on all these levels. Any comment or question? I can take 5 minutes or less worth of comment or question before I shake the tree a little bit. Okay, so first is Morty, and then it's going to be Len.
Could you expand on contemplate death? I'm fairly certain, but could you just expand on that?
If you ignore death, then you don't have to. You don't have to treat the question. When death becomes a prominent fact, then it's going to change you in some way, because it's going to bring you through a lot of denial and fear and anger and all those Elizabeth Kubler-Ross levels. But ultimately, it brings many people who are either on the threshold of death or work with dying people or contemplate death, it brings them to an acceptance of an embrace of that transition. In traditional Buddhist practice, they take practitioners to the graveyard and they sit them there for long periods of time. That's part of the practice. You sit in meditation or in the graveyard until you lose your unfamiliarity with death. Len.
Spence, last week you mentioned some characteristics of psychology that come from Buddhism that are the causes of our suffering. And I'm just wondering if you could, I think there were three or four things, if you could just repeat those.
I don't know what I said last week, but okay, but I'll tell you the Cliff Notes version of Buddha's Four Noble Truths. Noble Truth 1, unenlightened life is suffering, or involves a lot of suffering. Noble Truth 2, the cause of suffering is attachment. Either trying to grab stuff that is, by its very nature, is changing and fleeting, or trying to push stuff away that by its very nature has to come through. So the cause of suffering is grasping. Third noble truth, the release from suffering is, and these are my words for it, letting go into the present moment. The relief of suffering is letting go into the present moment. So that you're not grasping and you're not anticipating, you're just being with what is right now. And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is if you want to be able to let go into the present moment, you should probably live in these eight ways. It's just a prescription for how to live in an unperturbed, natural, connected way. Just a prescription for how for the path of a good life. So that's a short answer to that question. Okay, so we got in 2 minutes more. We're gonna go here. Okay, Chris.
Last week in the paper, Hospice had an article how they found out how unprepared people are for death, and rather than addressing the issue at the moment of death, they thought, how about offering a course preparing people? They expected to have maybe 7-8 people. 37 showed up, and hugely successful. And they used Stephen Levine's book on how to prepare for death.
Right, 1 Year to Live. Yeah, I've heard about that course. Stephen Levine wrote a book called 1 Year to Live, which you might want to look at. Okay, so let's see, Michael, and then two more, and then I have 1 minute left before I have to do this.
There's a great place to go in Santa Barbara to contemplate death. It's at a place called the Yoga Studio. In the back and upstairs, next to the public library shelf, there's a coffin that is behind curtains. There's a split open coffin, and people are encouraged to go in and relax, maybe close yourself in and just sit for a while. I've done it a number of times.
So it's a yoga suit. Ask for the coffin in yoga suit. Okay. So Colette, and then we have to go. Okay. Horizontal spirituality is if you kind of can't believe that there's somebody in a chair up there, you can still realize that best metaphor for horizontal spirituality. If we look at a field of grass, we see the field of grass. Each individual blade of grass says, "Oh my God, I'm dying! I only have a limited life." But we look at that and we go, "Come on, you're just one little bit of the field of grass. The life is in the field. You're just one little part of that life." We're all like little blades of grass, thinking that we are like individual lives, but we're breathing each other in and out every second. So something I learned when I was really little, a calculation done by Hans Haber, who wrote a book called Our Friend the Atom, shortly after the bomb got dropped. Anyway, he calculated that with every breath, you are breathing in 7 million atoms that were once breathed in by Jesus. Or anybody else, okay? So you're breathing in your friends right now. You're breathing in historical figures right now. And these atoms, of course, get into your body. So you're built of everything that's ever been alive. Okay, you're literally part of everything. So when you look at it this way, when you look at how interconnected we are and how the influence of your life will ripple through other people's lives and their lives through your life, then you see that it's not about me. You see that it's about the whole thing. And you increasingly are less focused on yourself and more focused on the whole thing. That's called wisdom. All right. What we need to do now is have the room made into a dark room so that we can show two videos. If somebody knows how to open those curtains, do it.
I'll do that.
Thank you.
All right, let me introduce this for you. A few years ago, some of you may remember a woman named Elizabeth Satouris came and talked to us here. What she basically talked to us about is the fact that most of us have learned a story about evolution that may not be entirely accurate. What we learn is the story that evolution has to do with survival of the fittest, that it's a competition, and that the way life moves forward is the fittest survive and the others don't, that it's a competition between individuals. That's a fairly male notion of evolution, and Elizabeth is not male, and wishes to suggest that that basic understanding that we were given in school may not be entirely true. So this is a talk she gave at Marrakesh, TEDx Marrakesh, very recently. It's only got a couple hundred views, but as you'll see, this is thanks to Len. Where's Len Jarrett? Okay, anyway, Len Jarrett, thank you, wherever you are. Okay. So, here we go. I hope
Whoops, hang on, I've got to make this into a computer that we have made.
That's good.
So East and West in our global family. I had fun looking at some of Buddha's poetry and playing with trying translation and stuff. And here we are in the Mid-Earth Sea. Mediterranean means Mid-Earth. And culturally, it truly is between West and East, between North and South. And those two red dots, of course, are Marrakesh and my Mallorca, where I live. So the ancient Greeks called science philosophia, the lover of wisdom. And the whole point was that this lover of wisdom takes guidance in human affairs from nature itself by studying. And that is exactly why I became a scientist, even though not all scientists agree that that was the true purpose of science. Anyway, being an evolution biologist makes you a deep pastist in order to be a good futurist, because if you know where you've come from, you stand a better chance of seeing where you might be able to go. We've had mostly great stories told by the major world's religions, and the Western Abrahamic religions on the one hand, the Eastern religions on the other, and they have only recently really started to come together. So the creation stories then changed because when secular societies were invented, developed, evolved, we gave science the mandate to tell us the creation story. And it gave us a story of a non-living universe with life of fierce struggle in scarcity against the tide of entropy running us down, and consciousness being squeezed out of brains eventually. Now, I think that's the saddest creation story I've ever heard. And so I had to look more deeply into it. It came from Thomas Malthus, who was Darwin's friend. And as Darwin said himself in The Origin of Species, this is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to every aspect of the animal and vegetable kingdom. So here was a socio-political theory applied to nature. So I had to look a little bit further into this. Is fierce competition really human nature? Well, what did the story do to us? It grew a world economy in which we liquidated the Earth's natural assets, as you've been hearing this morning. And they were driven by consumption growth, demand that we shot, literally, even after 9/11, tomorrow, the anniversary, that we should shop our way out of the disaster. We grew an economy that put us into the sixth global extinction, and humans are the first to cause one. If you stand on the moon and could see Earth over time, you would see that the distinction of our species is that we are a desert-making species. We have expanded deserts over time, and now with the hot eggs rolling on, we're going to make them even bigger. So, now we're adding also pollution-emitting and extinction-causing things like that to our biological claim to fame as a species. If aliens were watching us, and perhaps they are, would they consider us an intelligent species? Does an intelligent species destroy its own life support system? Here we are, we've got a popcorn effect going now of ever more frequent natural disasters. And at the same time, we've got ever more frequent human-made disasters of other kinds, and these crises seem to be leaving many of us in denial. Are we afraid of ourselves, that we don't know how to deal with everything from energy crises, food prices rising, terrorism, unemployment, etc., etc.? It's what we're facing today. So, no wonder we panic, deny, and go on shopping. And I suggest to you that what we need is a more inspiring story of ourselves and our future. So, let's see what we can do. What if there's more to this evolution story? What if evolution is an intelligent, improvisational dance, as a woman might see it, and also my favorite author, Lyle Watson? In the East, in Vedanta, in Tao, in Kodadama, consciousness is the source of all reality, rather than all reality being the source of consciousness. Quite a different view of things. So what if you see this great cosmic consciousness as the source of everything? And the physicists tell us that the universe is all made of vibrations, so why not call it a keyboard of frequencies? And as the cosmic consciousness begins to form worlds, mind and spirit are in the high vibrations, and then you get to this, what we call zero-point energy field as a source of particles, and then we get down, step it down a little further, you get electromagnetic energy, and eventually you get to the slower vibrations of matter, right? Western science starts at that end of the keyboard, and the Eastern religions were looking at consciousness from the other end of the keyboard. When are we going to realize that it's only one universe, it's all one keyboard? And we've got to take down the unnatural barriers that we set up between the music in the high keys and the music in the low keys. Rumi says, I have put duality away and see two worlds as one. Isn't that beautiful? If we assume the universe is alive, might biology be the leading science rather than physics and giving us the cosmology of intense self-creating living systems? It's a very different way of looking at things from the way I was taught. But many of my fellow scientists now see the Earth as being just as alive as the creatures it has given birth to. So I think life is just too intelligent to proceed one accident at a time, as I was taught in evolution biology. Now, interestingly, while the capitalist West had adopted the Darwinian competition mode of evolution, the communist East was picking up Kropotkin's story of evolution as cooperation. So both sides were politicizing the theory, and in my view, they're both half theories, and actually nature does both of these things. So let's look at what that would look like. If you see ecosystems as ecologists talk about them, you will see that they come in different varieties. A type 1 ecosystem, this called pioneer, is very Darwinian. Species are starving all the resources they can get. They're hogging territory, they're multiplying as fast as possible, and they're very competitive. Now, if you look over at the type 3 ecosystem called climax, implying sequence, but they don't see that sequence, it's very Kropotkinian. Everything's cooperating. They're sharing territory and resources, they're feeding each other. Very cooperative. What I saw there was a maturation curve from a youthful mode to a mature mode. And so I developed this theory. It starts with the unity, like the homogenized early Earth with all the minerals mixed up in the crust, indistinguishable. And from that unity is birthed individuation. Little bacteria tend to package themselves on the surface of the Earth. Whenever you have individuals, you start getting tension and conflict death. This is the Darwinian part of the cycle. If they don't kill each other off, they start some negotiations with each other. And some of those negotiations lead to strategies that resolve conflicts and actually set up cooperative schemes, which in the best case, and this is rare in evolution, is when a whole new unity is born at a larger size level as a cooperative. So let's see how it works. Here's my happier story of evolution, and I like to call it bacteria or us. Okay. Because you're going to see there, we are more like the ancient bacteria of Earth than any species in between. Really fun. The early Earth was populated only by these archaebacteria. Nowadays they're called archaea. And what they did was really remarkable because they're the first things that they covered the Earth, only bacteria, invisible. And they caused worldwide crises of hunger and then of pollution, and they solved them both. So they harnessed solar energy to develop photosynthesis to make food in the midst of a hunger crisis. They invented breathing as a way of life, and the breeders invented electric motors to get around in faster. The competitive stage always drives a lot of technology. Comes out of war, right? They created the first worldwide web of DNA exchange, an information language exchange worldwide, the first worldwide web, billions of years ago. And they evolved a huge cooperative new cell, which is the only other kind of cell ever to evolve on the Earth. It's the kind that you and I are made of. Okay, I can't show you the true size of the big cooperative because it has to be more than 1,000 times bigger than the little bacteria. But this is what the bacteria did. They got together, they all gave a little of their DNA to the central library called nucleus, and so they had less, they had to stay within the cell forever after, and they just did divisions of labor that gave you an extraordinarily complex, large cell. Now, what had happened was that the creative cooperation, that's the maturity represented by this big nucleated cell, becomes the junior, the new thing in the Earth. And what the bacteria had discovered in order to create that cooperative was that it's cheaper to feed your enemies than to kill them. Remember that, if nothing else in this talk. So after a feisty, competitive billion-year, another billion years, these nucleated cells built multi-celled creatures. That was the next stage in evolution where cooperation came in. So here we are, we're a big brain experiment, and the results are not yet in. But notice that even our brains integrate east and west, left and right hemispheres. Quite interesting. Now, no science is possible without making basic assumptions about the universe you're studying. You have to have some notion of what it is you're studying to theorize about it. So science rests on these cosmologies I started talking about at the beginning. And these fundamental assumptions or axioms, for instance, amount to a worldview, and in Western science, a non-living universe can be studied objectively without interfering in it. Consciousness emerges late in the game, and life has come from non-life. These are basic, unproven assumptions that are made. Okay, now whether consciousness creates matter or matter creates consciousness, it seems, turns out, to be a matter of belief called scientific axiom. It's cultural. It's what your current notion that seems perfectly obvious is all about, and that has differed in different parts of the world. Now, even in the West, some of us initiated what's called a paradigm shift, with cosmic life replacing non-life as the universal basic, and with consciousness primary instead of emerging late in the game. So, in 2008, I convened an international symposium to get scientists who had been taught the one set of assumptions and who had shifted to the other to write them all out very formally. And we did that in Hokkaido. We listed many assumptions in the process. And during the symposium, I had an epiphany. I was teaching an evolution biology of growing up out of competition into cooperation. And here I was participating in a paradigm shift where we were going to conquer the old assumptions and replace them with the new ones. And I said, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. Why don't we talk about a more global consortium of sciences where different cultures can publicly state their fundamental assumptions and play in the game of being legitimate sciences? So since two different cosmologies give us two different sciences, life arising from non-life by a series of fortuitous accidents in the one case, life arising by self-organization in the living universe in the other case, there we had two already. So I held a second symposium in Kuala Lumpur in 2009 for Islamic scientists. And we had them write down all their basic assumptions. And since Allah created the universe as the first one, and the second one is Allah created a living universe, I said, hooray, now we've got a living universe to work with. You won't get your credentials from Western science, but do something they haven't done. Do something they haven't done. And how about the science of economics that studies nature rather than assuming human nature? Imagine a consortium of East-West sciences with equal validity and mutual respect built on their culturally diverse assumptions. This solution, rather than the conquest of one paradigm by another, represents a mature collaborative mode, a fruitful division of labor that we need now to solve our global problems. So let's look back at our beginnings a bit. We've survived about a dozen ice ages. 99% of human history, we were hunter-gatherers living among large mammals. If any of you have not yet seen Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams, do go see it. What does this 32,000-year-old art tell us, this sensitivity, this love of these huge, scary animals? Were these painted maybe by women priestesses of the Mother Goddess? I don't know. But there's love there, and I think these people were cooperating with these animals in ways that many indigenous people still do. We can talk more about that later if you like. 100,000 years of cooperative communities, we reached that maturity at the tribal level. Then we went into empire mode. We built a large cooperative, a civilization, a city, and that became the new kid on the block. And so we now have the age of empires ending now, because empires went back into the juvenile mode, right? Of conquest, of all that yang stuff, the youthful competition, control, order, mine, yours, monoculture, fear and scarcity. And we're moving now to global family, to the yin of the mature cooperation, the messiness and mystery, the we and ours, the diversity and creativity, the love and abundance. So back to the moon. It's time for us to become a desert breeding species. Unfortunately, it's not difficult and it's not expensive. We have to adapt to life in a hot egg. We have the technologies to do it. Many discovered long ago in Morocco, and you just heard about solar desert solutions. They abound. And the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. We don't have to wait for the oil to run out. We don't have to. We already $2.4 trillion invested in new businesses around the world. We know that organic agriculture is healthy, restores soils, and makes jobs. The only way to double the food population, the food supply in the world, is to go back to small farms and natural methods. That is a fantastic thing that has not gotten into the press. Nature integrates opposites. It conserves what works. It's radically creative with what doesn't work. After every global extinction, you've got loads of new species appearing as if that didn't work, let's do something different. Crises always bring us opportunities, and it's our turn. We can and must reinvent our whole world. Hooray! What a great opportunity. It wasn't working. Okay? We need a real science of economics. And I hope that the Islamic scientists may distinguish themselves by doing that one. Based on nature's mature systems, such as our own bodies, every one of our bodies has 100 trillion cooperative cells, each as complex as a large human city, 30,000 recycling centers per cell, 1,000 bankers per cell, giving out free money, no debts. It's to spend in the economy. money was never intended to be issued as debt. All the religions forbade it thousands of years ago, the debt money. It shouldn't be either a commodity or a debt. So I'm going to end with this beautiful Hafiz poem in honor of Goethe and his love of Hafiz. Even after all this time, the sun never once says to Earth, Earth, you owe me. Look what happens with a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. And so I look at youth on the internet. I see they are not into racism, warfare, greed. In a single generation, they could create a new world, peaceful revolutions as we see them happening. So it's our evolutionary mandate to create sustainable global economics, to truly become a global family. And Rumi says, why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Or again, let the beauty of what you love be what you do. There are a thousand ways to kiss the earth. So I say to you all, do what makes your heart sing to make a better world for all. Thank you so much.
I'm going to turn the lights on for just a second. I'm going to switch to the second one. I just want to mention one thing. If you're really thoroughly a scientist, some of that probably upsets you. And so you think, well, that's a woman talking, but it's deep in the male being to compete. That's a woman talking about cooperation. Well, I read recently that, while preparing for a class at City College, that it is not, the basic story that we have about being male is your sperm outran 200 million other sperm and won that competition, and that's why that's why your dad's sperm made you, is because it was a competition that one sperm won to impregnate that egg. Turns out that's not true. Turns out that lots and lots of sperm have to attach to the egg before one can get in to do the fertilization. That back at the very basic level of being a man, there's both competition to get there and cooperation to enable one of our kind to bring life forward. I thought that was cool. all right, so anyway, now, so this could have been called questioning our story. Bob Weber here, I don't think he's here today, unfortunately. Going from Elizabeth, who gently questions our story, let's go to the guy who so ungently questions our basic story, that Ted banned him. I'm about to show you the banned TED Talk of Rupert Sheldrake. Okay. Which turns out, you can find it on YouTube. It has, last time I looked at it, 500,000 views, so it became a very popular TED Talk, even though it wasn't on TED. I'm not saying that everything Rupert says is right, but Rupert is certainly worth hearing. And this particular talk is brilliant. So this is Rupert Sheldrake's banned TED Talk. Okay. So let me see. Let me find it for you. So I think that even if you're a very conventional scientist, it's really good to have a gadfly like this to show you what your unquestioned fundamental assumptions are, so that you can look at whether or not you would come up with a different view of things if you questioned some of those assumptions, or if you made some different assumptions just to see what would be constructed out of those assumptions. So Rupert will question some of our basic assumptions in a very beautiful way. It's a great talk.
delusion is the belief that science already understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. This is a very widespread belief in our society. It's the kind of belief system of people who say, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. It's a belief system which has now been spread to the entire world. But there's a conflict in the heart of science between science as a method of inquiry based on reason, evidence, hypothesis, and collective investigation, and science as a belief system or a worldview. And unfortunately, the worldview aspect of science has come to inhibit and constrict the free inquiry, which is the very lifeblood of the scientific endeavor. Since the late 19th century, science has been conducted under the aspect of a belief system or worldview, which is essentially that of materialism, philosophical materialism. And the sciences are now wholly owned subsidiaries of the materialist worldview. I think that as we break out of it, the sciences will be regenerated. What I do in my book, The Science Delusion, which is called Science Set Free in the United States, is take the 10 dogmas or assumptions of science and turn them into questions, seeing how well they stand up if you look at them scientifically. None of them stand up very well. What I'm going to do is first run through what these 10 dogmas are, and then I'll only have time to discuss one or two of them in a bit more detail. But essentially, the 10 dogmas, which are the default worldview of most educated people all over the world, are first that nature is mechanical or machine-like. The universe is like a machine, animals and plants are like machines, we're like machines. In fact, we are machines. We are lumbering robots, in Richard Dawkins' vivid phrase, with brains that are genetically programmed computers. Second, matter is unconscious. The whole universe is made up of unconscious matter. There's no consciousness in stars, in galaxies, in planets, in animals, in plants, and there ought not to be any in us either, if this theory is true. So a lot of the philosophy of mind over the last 100 years has been trying to prove that we're not really conscious at all. So the matter's unconscious, then the laws of nature are fixed. This is dogma three. The laws of nature are the same now as they were at the time of the Big Bang, and they'll be the same forever. Not just the laws, but the constants of nature are fixed, which is why they're called constants. Dogma four, the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. It never changes in total quantity, except at the moment of the Big Bang, when it all sprang into existence from nowhere in a single instant. The fifth dogma is that nature is purposeless. There are no purposes in all nature, and the evolutionary process has no purpose or direction. Dogma six, biological heredity is material. Everything you inherit is in your genes, or in epigenetic modifications of the genes, or in cytoplasmic inheritance. It's material. Dogma 7, memories are stored inside your brain as material traces. Somehow everything you remember is in your brain in modified nerve endings, phosphorylated proteins. No one knows how it works, but nevertheless, almost everyone in the scientific world believes it must be in the brain. Dogma 8, your mind is inside your head. All your consciousness is the activity of your brain and nothing more. Dogma 9, which follows from Dogma 8, psychic phenomena like telepathy are impossible. Your thoughts and intentions cannot have any effect at a distance because your mind is inside your head. Therefore, all the apparent evidence for telepathy and other psychic phenomena is illusory. People believe these things happen, but it's just because they don't know enough about statistics, or they're deceived by coincidences, or it's wishful thinking. And dogma 10, mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. That's why governments only fund research into mechanistic medicine and ignore complementary and alternative therapies. Those can't possibly really work because they're not mechanistic. They may appear to work because people would have got better anyway, or because of the placebo effect. But the only kind that really works is mechanistic medicine. Well, this is the default worldview, which is held by almost all educated people all over the world. It's the basis of the educational system, the National Health Service, the Medical Research Council, governments, and it's just the default worldview of educated people. But I think every one of these dogmas is very, very questionable. And when you look at it, they fall apart. I'm going to take first the idea that the laws of nature are fixed. This is a hangover from an older worldview before the 1960s when the Big Bang Theory came in. People thought that the whole universe was eternal, governed by eternal mathematical laws. When the Big Bang came in, then that assumption continued, even though the Big Bang revealed a universe that's radically evolutionary, about 14 billion years old, growing and developing and evolving for 14 billion years, growing and cooling, and more structures and patterns appear within it. But the idea is all the laws of nature were completely fixed at the moment of the Big Bang, like a cosmic Napoleonic code. As my friend Terence McKenna used to say, modern science is based on the principle, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nothing in a single instant. Well, in an evolutionary universe, why shouldn't the laws themselves evolve? After all, human laws do, and the idea of laws of nature is based on a metaphor with human laws. It's a very anthropocentric metaphor. Only humans have laws. In fact, only civilized societies have laws. As C.S. Lewis once said, to say that a stone falls to earth because it's obeying a law makes it a man and even a citizen. It's a metaphor that we got so used to, we forget it's a metaphor. In an evolving universe, I think a much better idea is the idea of habits. I think the habits of nature evolve. The regularities of nature are essentially habitual. This was an idea put forward at the beginning of the 20th century by the American philosopher C.S. Peirce. And it's an idea which various other philosophers have entertained. It's one which I myself have developed into a scientific hypothesis, the hypothesis of morphic resonance, which is the basis of these evolving habits. According to this hypothesis, everything in nature has a kind of collective memory. Resonance occurs on the basis of similarity. As a young giraffe embryo grows in its mother's womb, it tunes in to the morphic resonance of previous giraffes. It draws on that collective memory, it grows like a giraffe, and it behaves like a giraffe because it's drawing on this collective memory. It has to have the right genes to make the right proteins, but genes, in my view, are grossly overrated. They only account for the proteins that the organism can make, not the shape or the form or the behavior. Every species has a kind of collective memory. Even crystals do. This theory predicts that if you make a new kind of crystal for the first time, the very first time you make it, it won't have an existing habit. But once it crystallizes, then the next time you make it, there'll be an influence from the first crystals to the second ones all over the world by morphic resonance. It'll crystallize a bit easier. The third time, there'll be an influence from the first and second crystals. There is, in fact, good evidence that new compounds get easier to crystallize all around the world, just as this theory would predict. It also predicts that if you train animals to learn a new trick, for example, rats learn a new trick in London, then all around the world, rats of the same breed should learn the same trick quicker, just because the rats have learned it here. And surprisingly, there's already evidence that this actually happens. Anyway, that's my own hypothesis in a nutshell of morphic resonance. Everything depends on evolving habits, not on fixed laws. But I want to spend a few moments on the constants of nature too, because these are again assumed to be constant. Things like the gravitational constant, the speed of light, are called the fundamental constants. Are they really constant? Well, when I got interested in this question, I tried to find out. They're given in physics handbooks, handbooks of physics list the existing fundamental constants, tell you their value. But I wanted to see if they changed. So I got the old volumes of physical handbooks. I went to the Patent Office Library here in London, and they're the only place I could find that kept the old volumes. You know, normally people throw them away when the new values come out. They throw away the old ones. When I did this, I found that the speed of light dropped between 1928 and 1945 by about 20 kilometers per second. It's a huge drop, because they're given with errors of only fractions of a second, decimal points of error. And yet, all over the world, it dropped, and they were all getting values very similar to each other with tiny errors. Then in 1945, it went up, in 48, it went up again. And then people started getting very similar values again. I was very intrigued by this, and I couldn't make sense of it. So I went to see the head of metrology at the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington. Metrology is the science in which people measure constants. And I asked him about this. I said, what do you make of this drop in the speed of light between 1928 and 1945? And he said, oh dear, he said, you've uncovered the most embarrassing episode in the history of the science. So, I said, well, could the speed of light have actually dropped? And that would have amazing implications if so. He said, no, of course it couldn't have actually dropped. It's a constant. Well, then how do you explain the fact everyone was finding it going much slower during that period? Is it because they were fudging their results to get what they thought other people should be getting, and the whole thing was just produced by in the minds of physicists? We don't like to use the word fudge. I said, well, what do you prefer? And he said, well, we prefer to call it intellectual phase locking. So I said, well, if it was going on then, how can we be so sure it's not going on today? And that the present values are produced by intellectual phase locking. And he said, oh, we know that's not the case. I said, how do we know? He said, well, we've solved the problem. I said, well, how? He said, well, we fixed the speed of light by definition in 1972. So I said, but it might still change. He said, yes, but we never know it, because we've defined meter in terms of the speed of light. So the units have changed with it. So he looked very pleased about that. They fixed their problem. But I said, well, then what about big G, the gravitational constant known in the trade as big G? It's written with a capital G, Newton's universal gravitational constant. That's varied by more than 1.3% in recent years. And it seems to vary from place to place and from time to time. And he said, oh, well, those are just errors. And unfortunately, there are quite big errors with big G. So I said, well, what if it's really changing? I mean, perhaps it is really changing. And then I looked at how they do it. What happens is they measure it in different labs. They get different values on different days. And then they average them. And then other labs around the world do the same. And they come out usually with a rather different average. And then the International Committee on Metrology meets every 10 years or so and average the ones from labs around the world to come up with the value of big G. But what if G were actually fluctuating? What if it changed? There's already evidence, actually, that it changes throughout the day and throughout the year. What if the Earth, as it moves through the galactic environment, went through patches of dark matter or other environmental factors that could alter it? Maybe they will change together. What if these errors are going up together and down together? For more than 10 years, I've been trying to persuade metrologists to look at the raw data. In fact, I'm now trying to persuade them to put it online on the internet with the dates and the actual measurements and see if they're correlated, to see if they're all up at one time or down at another. If so, they might be fluctuating together, and that would tell us something very, very interesting. But no one has done this. They haven't done it because G is a constant. There's no point looking for changes. You see, here's a very simple example of where a dogmatic assumption actually inhibits inquiry. I myself think that the constants may vary quite considerably, well, within narrow limits, but they may all be varying. And I think the day will come when scientific journals like Nature have a weekly report on the constants, like stock market reports in newspapers. This week, big G was slightly up, the speed of the electron was down, the speed of light held steady, and so on. That's one area, just one area where I think thinking less dogmatically could open things up. One of the biggest areas is the nature of the mind. This is the most unsolved problem, as Graham just said, that science simply can't deal with the fact we're conscious. And it can't deal with the fact that our thoughts don't seem to be inside our brains. Our experiences don't all seem to be inside our brain. Your image of me now doesn't seem to be inside your brain, yet the official view is there's a little Rupert somewhere inside your head, and everything else in this room is inside your head. Your experience is inside your brain. I'm suggesting, actually, that vision involves an outward projection of images. What you're seeing is in your mind, but not inside your head. Our minds are extended beyond our brains in the simplest act of perception. I think that we project out of the images we're seeing, and these images touch what we're looking at. If I look at you from behind, you don't know I'm there, could I affect you? Could you feel my gaze? There's a great deal of evidence that people can. The sense of being stared at is an extremely common experience, and recent experimental research suggests it's real. Animals seem to have it too. I think it probably evolved in the context of predator-prey relationships. Prey animals that could feel the gaze of the predator would survive better than those that couldn't. This would lead to a whole new way of thinking about ecological relationships between predators and prey, also about the extent of our minds. If we look at distant stars, I think our minds reach out in a sense to touch those stars and literally extend out over astronomical different distances. They're not just inside our heads. Now, it may seem astonishing that this is a topic of debate in the 21st century. We know so little about our own minds that where our images are is a hot topic of debate within consciousness studies right now. I don't have time to deal with any more of these dogmas, but every single one of them is questionable. If one questions it, new forms of research, new possibilities open up. And I think as we question these dogmas that have held back science so long, science will undergo a reflowering, a renaissance. I'm a total believer in the importance of science. I've spent my whole life as a research scientist, my whole career. But I think by moving beyond these dogmas, it can be regenerated once again and become interesting and, I hope, life-affirming. Thank you.
About three things. First, in 2 minutes. Three things in 2 minutes. First, why was it banned? It was banned because it questions the unquestioned assumptions on which our world is built. And some scientists get very insecure when they hear stuff like that and say, that's pseudoscience, it's stupid. But obviously, it shouldn't have been banned. It should have been put on TED with a disclaimer like Nature does when it publishes, you know, articles which shake a paradigm. It says, we don't necessarily believe this, but you ought to at least consider it. That's what science does. It says, we'll look at anything instead of saying, oh, no, we don't want to look at that. That was the worst of TED. I mean, that really started TED's, as far as I'm concerned. It should have been definitely put on TED with Chris Anderson or somebody saying beforehand, look, this is why you want to take this with a grain of salt. This is a controversial thing. We're going to put it on here because it's thought-provoking, and if it turns out to be nonsense, then it'll be nonsense by consensus rather than nonsense by definition. So that's the first thing. Second thing is... it's really helpful to have people in any field that look at the fundamental building blocks of that field and question those building blocks. An example is in psychology, a guy named Thomas Szasz, remember him?
Yes.
Who wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness, in which he said, they're not crazy, we're just calling them crazy because we don't like them. Now, I don't think Szasz was right, But what Zags did is he made us open our eyes and realize how, to what extent mental health diagnosis was politicized, and to what extent it was repressive, and to what extent it was discriminatory. You know, so he really changed psychology in a very healthy way by being a gadfly. That, if you don't have gadflies, you get groupthink, where you make Bay of Pigs invasions because nobody will say, hey, that might not be such a good idea. So you really have to encourage that, not go in the opposite direction. And the third thing I want to say is, more general than science, which we're going to look at frontier, this is called frontier science. Maybe nonsense, but it's certainly worth, if it's nonsense, then we should be able to call it nonsense in a very convincing way, rather than to say, no, we won't look at that. And the third thing that I want to say is, in terms of your own life, I think that for first chakra problems, but more generally for your whole life's health, I think it's really important to question your fundamental assumptions, aka question your basic beliefs, the things that you hold to be absolutely true in the building blocks of your life. Some of those fundamental assumptions are limits that don't actually exist. I think it's really important to look at those unquestioned ways that you look at the world and yourself. We need to break now. Carrie, you want to say?
Tomorrow night, I think some PBS program tonight called Cosmos.
Oh, is that the first one of Neil deGrasse Tyson? Okay, so it's Carl Sagan brought forward. It's on. I thought it was on Fox. I think it's on Fox. I mean, tune into that if you can. When is it? It starts tomorrow night.
It's called Sunday night.
Yeah. Sunday night. It's called The Cosmic Journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not called Cosmic. It's called Carl Sagan. It's called The Cosmic Journey. Okay.
Cosmos,
The Journey?
Yeah. Something like that.
Just Google it. All right. We got to Gary, and then we got to get out of here. Gary.
Tomorrow afternoon at 3 at Campbell Hall, the scientist named Lisa Randall speaking.
Yeah, so that's true. Tomorrow at Campbell Hall at 3 o'clock, this physicist Lisa Randall, who's apparently very good to a very good presenter. Carl, what do you know?
If you can't make that talk, look on the internet. She's got some very excellent lectures on the internet.
Ah, perfect. Always look on the internet. Fred?
After the dismiss, are we still going to have the extra time to do this and that?
We're going to have about 5 minutes or 10 minutes to do art. So if you need to leave, leave quietly and quickly. Otherwise, stay for a few minutes. We're going to do art. So Fred, come on up.
I'd like to share another point.
We have to be quick about this because they need to set up. So here goes. So if you need to leave, leave quietly and quickly. First, let's look at the visual art, then we're going to have a couple poems, and then we'll dismiss. First, visual art.
Oh, that's me.
Say about this.
It's a collage I did. It's a triptych. And the subject is nesting. We nest from birth to death.
Ah. So come up and take a look at this.
And all the twigs. Sayings of poetry and nesting.
No kidding.
Yeah.
They do. Well, you got to see all that. The nest is composed of sayings and poetry. So come up and take a look at it. Okay. From birth to death.
Okay, these are my last pictures of Omani people. The first one is in a Bedouin tent in the desert. And after I took the picture, I was told you can't take pictures of women. Well, too late. The other one is in a marketplace that these men are selling birds. And I would just like to say in conclusion, if you want a place to travel that's exotic, different, and very safe, I recommend Oman. It's beautiful.
Very good.
Okay. Go for it, Fred.
All right. I feel a little bit out of place because this is not original, but I wanted to share something with you because very few people seem to be aware. Stephen Crane. Anybody ever heard of him?
Yeah.
Red Badge of Courage. Most people don't know anything about his poetry. One of the things I like about it, it tends to be short. I don't like to read 50 pages. And it's a little twisted like I am. Oh, anyway, let me give you a couple of examples. Many workmen built a huge bog masonry upon a mountaintop. And then they went to the valley below and they turned to behold their work. It is grand, they said. They loved the thing. All of a sudden, it moved. It came upon them swiftly and crushed them all to blood. But some had opportunity to squeal. Now, if you don't share, you know, this kind of thing, you don't have to read it. But there, I don't know what it is in me that, you know, just immediately jumped out at these. One more, I'm better. Many red devils ran from my heart and out upon the page. They were so tiny the pen could mash them. And many struggled in the ink. It was strange to write in this red muck of the things from my heart.
Wow, beautiful. Anything else? Abraham's got a poem. And then, anybody besides that? Okay, so Abraham is going to be the last poem. And then on your way out, if you could put your birthplace, that would be really helpful. Okay, yeah.
Somebody asked about contemplating death. I have the best quote that I found about death. I even put it in my book, what Tagore says about death. And I would like to share it with you.
Tagore.
Tagore. Yeah, an Indian poet.
What page?
Death is not extinguishing the light.
What page?
It's only 31. It's only putting out the lamp because the dawn has come.
Did you hear that?
Say it again.
Okay.
Death is not extinguishing the light. It's only putting out the lamp because the dawn has come.
Nice.
And I say, it's a freeing thought, a birth of something new, and cures the fever called life. Fear it not.
Oh. All right, don't question your fundamental assumptions. And don't get in trouble.